Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's conversation is one that I know will impact many of the listeners because, quite frankly, we're going to be talking about something that many of the listeners talk to me about. Let me introduce you to James Ochoa, who is a licensed professional counselor, and he is also the founder and director of the Life Empowerment Center in Austin, Texas. And as if that weren't enough, James is also the author of Focused Forward, Navigating the Storms of Adult ADHD. James Ochoa, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks so much, Pamela. I really look forward to our discussion today.
Well, you just heard me describe your third hat, if you will, as the author of Focused Forward. And you do not come to the creation of Focused Forward without your own personal insight. So I'd like to start our conversation today with talking to you about your own experiences as being an adult with ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Talk about your description of what ADHD is and is not.
Well, I'd be happy to. And as always, with ADHD adults or adults diagnosed with ADHD, it's an adventurous story. I'll say it that way. And so I came to the table in understanding adult ADHD for myself actually as a professional. And as a professional, I noticed it in about 1996 after I'd been working 5 or 6 years in the field. And my understanding, you know, is I always had difficulty with organizing and following through and maintaining some level of consistency, but I had always kind of set it off as something that was not a big deal, or I just tried to run past it as much as I could. And so I recognized that, actually, as I write about in the book, that I had actually written or bought a computerized test for visual and auditory attention regarding the diagnosis of ADHD, and I actually couldn't do that computerized test in front of 50 or 60 colleagues that we were being trained with it on. And afterwards, the developer was like, he thought I was pretending to be ADHD. And I told him, I saw him about 6 months later at a national conference, and I told Joe, I said, you know, I really couldn't do that test. And I showed him my scores, and we went over them, and it was then that I began to get a clue about my own adult ADHD, because before then, all my learning issues had been settled into a childhood injury I had at 4 years old. I had a closed head injury. And I thought all my learning problems had come from that spectrum, and they actually had not. It was a genetic issue as I began to understand it, and it ran on my mother's side of the family. But it was quite an enlightening space for me in the mid-90s.
Well, you know, what's interesting is so many times I've certainly heard, and I'm sure you have as well, adults say, well, nobody ever said anything to me about this before. You know, what are you talking about, ADHD? Either I've never heard that before, or that's just for kids.
Yes. And, you know, I began working with adults in 1992, actually through the drug and alcohol treatment field. So I've been working with children for the since about 89, and so in 92 I began working with adults in an alcohol treatment center, and a lot of these were ADHD adults. They had been diagnosed as kids, but they were using drugs and alcohol in a way that was much more about self-medicating their learning disability than it was anything else.
Talk to us a little. I want to go backwards a little bit. As you reflect back on what your life experiences were like, as a person with ADHD. Tell us a little bit about what that storm actually looked like in the life of James.
I believe that storm looked like cycles, that I would go through great difficulty or impulsiveness in making decisions that turned out poorly, whether that was adolescent difficulties at times in my drug or alcohol use as an adolescent, or just in my frustrations, say, in the evening when I was studying and I could not stay focused on my work. And I didn't know why. I think probably one of the most pointed examples for me growing up really has to be one was in second grade and learning to read, which was enormously difficult for me. And I had a nun at the Catholic school that I was in, Sister Floretta, who kept me after school every day and taught me how to read slowly. And it was just an enormously labor-intensive process that, you know, many of my siblings had to bear waiting for me after school and things like that. And all the way through high school, Pamela, I had a very difficult time getting my words out on the paper in a reasonable way. And, you know, through my senior year in high school, my mother would actually type my papers. I would pace behind her and tell her what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it, and she would help me formulate it. And as I look back, those are all the challenges that come with ADHD, the difficulty with evaluating, the difficulty with prioritizing and putting things in order in a way that is reasonable for others to understand how it's done.
So
go ahead.
I'm thinking about just that little James who had to stay after school to learn how to read. At that age, I don't think children are particularly loving being singled out.
No, they weren't, and I wasn't. It did not. It felt like a punishment, certainly, or it felt like something I had to do. There are a lot of memories of walking back or walking to the car where my siblings were waiting for me. Growing up in Texas, it wasn't always the most comfortable place to be. It's always pretty hot here. And so it was a challenge, and it was frustrating at times. But, you know, as I look back, I mean, her guidance, my second grade teacher's guidance at the time, was enormously helpful to me, and it really did carry me through. But you're right. It was not an easy childhood in that way, not knowing why you were as frustrated as you were or things were as difficult as they were, and you really didn't understand it. It didn't seem that way for other kids.
So, in fact, your self-esteem would have been pretty challenged pretty early on, and I would think fairly consistently.
It was. And so, as I discuss in the book on the ideas of the emotional distress syndrome, which is the frustration, right, and the emotional and mental stress that really spin around the diagnosis of ADHD, I really did, that started early on. My self-esteem was challenged. I grew up in a very loving home. I had two parents that really had an enormous amount of love for us and caring as best they could with so many children, because if folks get a chance, if they choose to look or read at the book, you know, I grew up in a family of eight children, right? And so there were seven kids in 8 years. My youngest brother was born 4 years after I was born. And so it was organized chaos, Pamela, and it was a very difficult time, and my self-esteem was really challenged. But, you know, I would do things to take care of myself in ways that I didn't know I was. Okay, so one of the stories I tell is that at 8 or 9 years old, I would go into our only single bathroom in the home of a three-bedroom, one-bath house that we grew up in, and I would fill the bathtub up and sink under the water to where, you know, I could still certainly breathe, but I would sink under the water until it got cold so that I could really feel calm again as I understand it today. I didn't know what I was doing then, but I knew that it helped then, and it was something that I gravitated toward. So I think that happens with a lot of folks with ADHD or learning disabilities, that we do things to take care of ourselves in ways we're not even aware of.
Is it conceivable that someone could have ADHD as a child and not be critically aware of it and certainly not be diagnosed until they were an adult? Or does ADHD ever start in adulthood?
No, it does not start in adulthood. So as a genetic condition, it starts in childhood, and it's a developmental condition, so you're born with it. And, you know, it's passed on, Pamela, at the rate of hair color, height, and weight. So it's very inheritable. And the degree to which someone has the diagnosis as far as severity really depends on how the DNA genetic structure lines up when they're born. And so many children wouldn't say grow out of it in some ways, because it does go into adulthood, you know, as far as symptoms are concerned for many of us. But it does not start in adulthood. So you've got to have the symptoms before the age of 12 now on the diagnostic measures. But many adults and many children circumvent those difficulties. They get around them in a way that they're not even aware of what they're doing or why they have to do it as it's related to ADHD.
So already what we're talking about is sort of the innate creativity and resilience of folks with ADHD who do find a way to sort of take care of themselves, whether or not they know what that's what they were doing. I mean, the picture of you sort of, you know, lying in the tub until you calm down, I mean, that's ingenious.
It is. As I think back on it, Pamela, I'm like, that was one of the smartest things I could have done. But that's what I think adults diagnosed with ADHD who understand how to manifest their lives or get back to a sense of resilience. Many of us can go back to our childhood and find those kernels or those times that we really felt good or we did things to take care of ourselves. But if you look at the emotional stress that we were under at the time, particularly myself, those stress memories typically would overwhelm any of those good memories. So I think I got that good memory back, or that idea of it, you know, after many years of understanding my own stress cycles.
You talked a moment ago about emotional distress syndrome. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what that means.
Essentially, I define this as it is the mental and emotional stress factors that spin off of the diagnosis of ADHD. So if you look at the diagnosis of ADHD, we know that there is an underactivity and differences in several areas of the brain structure. It doesn't mean they're not working. It means they're underactive. But because they're underactive, they work in fits and starts, as I talk about it. And so many folks with ADHD gravitate toward high stress, chaos, and intensity. Much of that, we believe, could be that they're trying to actually push their adrenal cycles to help them focus and concentrate some. It's a little bit of a separate conversation. But essentially, the mental and emotional stress, Pamela, that comes off of that chaos and intensity is what starts to erode their sense of self-esteem, how they really feel about themselves and how they like themselves, or their self-identity, which is their value in the world, okay, and how they think their IQ is and where they can make a difference. And I talk about those as two pillars. And when those pillars get slammed by stress over and over and over again, they really do, unfortunately, become piles of rubble for a lot of people that they're trying to stand on. They aren't pillars anymore. And so the emotional distress syndrome is that chronic nature of the mental and emotional issues that spin off of this. And I'll have to tell you, you know, I could talk for weeks about this, because as a professional, it was the most challenging issue in working with my clients to really resolve and to really find a way to manage. And, you know, it took me a number of years, obviously, but I'm really happy that I have a way that I can really teach clients to, in a sense, rebuild. And for some clients, Pamela, it's they have to build those pillars for the first time to really care about themselves and to really feel like they're valuable. Does that give you a sense of what the emotional distress syndrome is?
Absolutely. And what it also says is that there's a way to manage it such that you can feel better and more productive within yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the piece that I go through in the book, that there are many things that individuals can do to really start to rebuild that internal sense of themselves so they feel more confident, more courageous. They can really stand in the storm, so to speak, and not lose balance as often.
Is it your
view? Well, say it happens as often. I still lose balance sometimes, but I come back to center more effectively now.
Welcome to being human, right?
Exactly. And that's a whole other space, right? This is it is being human. And I say a funny thing that, you know, one of the difficulties with the diagnosis of ADHD today, Pamela, and particularly for adults, when they begin to discover the disruption and it begins to make sense to them, is many people will say to them, well, everyone has attention problems. And the challenge with that statement is it's true. From time to time, everyone has attention issues based on having a cold, based on not sleeping well. What we're talking about in the diagnosis of ADHD, though, is a chronic disruption in the nature of the attention span. It doesn't mean they can't be successful, but it means that if you don't know about that, then you constantly feel like you're being thrown out of balance, and you really don't understand why. So everyone has attention problems from time to time. That is not what the diagnosis of ADHD is, though.
Okay. Is it your view that everyone with ADHD will experience emotional distress?
Boy, that's a great question. Here's how I would answer that. Yes, everyone is going to experience mental and emotional distress as a result of the genetic setup and the neurology of their minds and how they look at life. They don't have to necessarily fall into the emotional distress syndrome, as I would call it, which is really the disruption and not knowing how to calm yourself that comes off the diagnoses. So I've had children I've treated since they were 8, 9, 10 years old, who are now in their mid-20s, early 30s, and they grew up in very loving, supportive households that sought help in really significant ways. And these children did not develop the emotional distress syndrome. Doesn't mean they don't go through storms themselves, but they don't kick themselves at the end of the day so hard at a level that really shatters their sense of esteem and identity. So I think if it's not understood well, it's not managed well, you don't know how to navigate your life with it well, it can become a syndrome. So everyone feels the mental and emotional stress as a result of having the diagnoses, for sure.
All right, but again, what I'm hearing is that there are clear ways to manage, to navigate, such that diagnosis or no, you can actually live your life in the way that works for you.
Absolutely. And that's what I have seen over the last 10 to 12 years in my practice. And I say just over the 10 to 12 years because I've been in practice for 26 years. But I really didn't feel like I had a handle on how to help folks get reconnected and stay connected to themselves.
Okay. James, we're going to take a break, and we will be back in just a moment. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk, and I am having a conversation with James Ochoa, who is a licensed professional counselor, the founder and director of the Life Empowerment Center in Austin, Texas, as well as, more recently, the author of Focused Forward, Navigating the Storms of Adult ADHD. We'll be right back. James, don't go away.
Great.
James, just as an aside, I notice in the production of this book that it is visually, physically created with mindfulness about folks with ADHD. You know, in years past, I think we've all seen these books that are, I mean, they kind of look like Bibles. You know, they're so thick and the type is so condensed that, you know, even if you didn't have ADHD, it might be a challenge. And this is a small book. It's not overwhelming. It's clearly broken down into segments. So if you've got something you want to learn about, you can go right there. So I appreciate that. And I just wanted to note that.
Great. I appreciate that you see it in that way, because it's exactly how it was designed for someone who has the diagnosis of ADHD and can get information quickly. And I worked very painstakingly with my writing coach and editor, Robin, who really understood how to bring that voice. And then the graphic artist and Kim Iberg was the one who did the cover and did all the layout inside as far as how it looks and how it flows, and it really did make a difference. So I really appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, I absolutely, it makes a huge difference. You know, one of the things that you said earlier that I just wanted to go back to for a moment, I think about the folks who I'm aware of with ADHD, and to a person, they find themselves in professional careers that are nonstop stress, nonstop change, and while that may be stimulating, it's more than a notion to negotiate all of it.
Absolutely. And so it is quite a challenge, particularly for an adult diagnosed with ADHD. And if you don't know that you have it, being in a career that's very stimulated and fast-paced, albeit can be incredibly exciting at times, but the fast pace will certainly, you know, you run a high risk of physical and emotional and mental stress just based on the pace. And so you do find adults with ADHD gravitating toward high-stress element jobs, say an emergency medical room doctor. I've treated several of those over the years. And interestingly enough, several of them have been incredibly successful because it's the way that they've structured their life now, right? So it's what I would call a very personalized strategy that they will work intensely for 36 hours or 24 hours, and then they'll be off for 3 days. And so they set up their life with good structure around it, but they go in and work intensely, and they really appreciate and enjoy that, and then they take care of themselves on the time off. So looking at how an adult with ADHD designs their career or designs their life is something I talk an enormous amount about with my clients.
Sounds like I shouldn't go to the library looking for a librarian with ADHD.
No, but it's interesting you would say that. I have seen them come from all walks of life. Librarians, accountants, all the detail management careers, I have seen it there. And so a librarian would, if they were had ADHD, Pamela, they would enjoy the way the patterns of the books set up on the shelf, or they would appreciate the Dewey Decimal System, whichever it is, but they would find a personal connection to it. But no, I've pretty much seen every career walk into my office with adult ADHD behind it.
Now, you've used a word on more than one occasion that one does not necessarily think about or naturally experience as we talk about ADHD. And I know that you know the word that I'm going to focus on, structure.
Yes.
Talk about structure.
So structure in regards to the diagnosis of ADHD becomes critically important to be personalized, okay? The personalized piece is the enormously important factor there. So if you look at the underactivity in the neurology again, that sets up difficulty with planning, evaluating, and prioritizing many times. Well, structure is part of that evaluating and planning piece. And as a very brief side note, you know, those who are not diagnosed with ADHD, that evaluative planning, prioritizing structure fully develops now, we know, in your mid to late 20s. And so for people who don't have ADHD, that becomes more of an automatic process, like reading or walking. Okay, so it's not something they have to do with what I call as a third-party thought about it. For us with ADHD, I have to create a personal structure and a strategy to deal with the routines of my life. So I have to know where I put my car keys. I have to know where I orient my systems and my notes. And I have a secretary here, assistant at my office, Kim, who's been with me 17 years, and a funny little tidbit. So we've come up with a personal strategy for structure for me, Pamela, that in getting information and notes to me, I have a busy practice, but we're talking about a two-person system here. It's not like we don't see each other all the time, but Kim will write notes on these little metal notepads for me and put it on this big paper clip, right? And they're in bright colors. And that's how she makes sure that I don't forget and I keep up with things. And my biggest challenge, which I think when Kim hears this, she'll laugh, is that I will tear those notes up when they're finished so that I know that it's done, and I like doing that. But sometimes I tear them up too fast. It's like, wait, don't tear that one up. So structure is really important, but it has to be personalized. This is where the real challenge comes in, Pamela, that those diagnosed with ADHD many times are given, here are your 20 items that you need to do to correct your life. And they're like, none of them make sense to me. I don't like them. And so I have to sit with clients and develop what I call personalized structures and strategies and routines. Yet one of the challenges within the spectrum of adult ADHD and ADHD in general is you will go through a consistently inconsistent pattern. Things work for a while. Now they're not as interesting. They fall off my radar. And so I also talk a lot about resetting systems. So how do you reset if I start to not look at the notes on Kim's desk, or I start to not get my bills paid one month and the electricity gets turned off? It's not that I don't have the funds, it's just that I forgot to pay it. Then I have to reset that system. I have to put it in a new arena. I have to use a different colored ink. It doesn't have to be big, but I have to engage my brain and my neurology in a way that's interesting again. And we have to do that over and over again the rest of our lives. Sometimes I wish it wasn't that way, but that's how it shows up. So with the structure piece, it's got to be very personalized.
And I am now taking a look at Focus Forward, and I'm looking at your list of put this on your refrigerator. And very much at the top of the list is, and I am now quoting, it's not natural to plan, prioritize, or think ahead.
Correct.
If it is not done very deliberately, it will not happen.
Correct.
So you've got to plan, prioritize, and think ahead, whether that is natural for you or not.
Absolutely, because that's the way the world is ordered, right, Pamela? We all have rules that we agree to and responsibilities and things to do. And it's not as natural for us in the underactivity of the neurologies of our mind. It doesn't mean that we can't do it or find a way to do it. We may be a little short-sighted, as I will say, or nearsighted. But we can bring it into focus with really personal ways of kind of putting things together to make sure I follow through with things, for sure.
You also say take personal responsibility for your ADHD. Now, we're talking about something that the person with ADHD doesn't create for themselves. It's not a matter of just pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and paying attention. So you didn't create it. You didn't take it on intentionally. You didn't ask for it. So explain the concept of taking personal responsibility for something that you did not create.
So the idea of taking personal responsibility for all of us, whether you have ADHD or not, is that, yes, we were born into this life with certain characteristics and certain physical features and all these other pieces that we're responsible for, right? We're not having other people do things for us. We're not blaming it on the world. That is what I call a third-party position. It's outside of yourself. So when I look at the diagnosis of ADHD, and I get this with adolescents that I treat and many times with parents, that I tell them, and even with adults, when people come into my practice and they have new information about how they process information and what they do, now they're more responsible than they were before because it was an unknown before. It was something that I could beg off or say, I don't know what it is, and it was a valid statement. With a diagnosis of ADHD, the personal responsibility comes from, okay, I know my mind gets thrown off track. I know I have to reset. I know I have difficulty with organizing, so I'm the one that has to step in front of that. It is not okay for me, with anyone who works with me, for them to say, well, the world just doesn't understand me, or I can't do this because it's too hard because this system made the rules the wrong way. I'm like, okay, well, you could complain about that your entire life, and or you could go in and engage with personal systems or strategies and say, okay, how am I going to manage this? One of the other markers on the personal responsibility piece, Pamela, has a lot to do with helping others understand what works best for you or ways to explain ADHD and what it is or is not. And so I tell a lot of my clients, you tell people around you, this is a genetic condition like height, weight, or hair color. I've learned to manage it. I will go through storms. I'll do my best not to, you know, affect people around me any more than it's going to, but I know how to manage this. That key piece right there is what the emotional distress syndrome throws out of balance most often. Because we feel like failures, we feel like I can never do it, I'll never reach my potential. And so when I think about the idea of taking personal responsibility, it is something that has taken me years to really get around, but it's otherwise, what are we left with? We're left with, you know, a sense of victimhood or a sense that someone is doing something to me that I can't manage. And that's not okay with me. That's just not how I live my life.
You, excuse me, you talk about helping others to understand what's going on with you and your ability to manage it. Does that mean that you tell employers that you have been diagnosed with ADHD?
Well, that's an interesting question as well, because in the employment world, certainly the diagnosis of ADHD is protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act, okay? And so you can receive reasonable accommodations in the workplace if you acknowledge or help the HR department to understand that you have the diagnosis of ADHD. And I've seen that happen successfully, where I can wear headphones when I'm working on something. I can, instead of looking out the window, I'm going to place my desk in a way that I'm not distracted as easily. But this is how I tell the majority of my clients to do it, because, Pamela, there is still too much of a knee-jerk reaction to the diagnostic name of ADHD. Most of it is misunderstanding, and most of it is not really knowing, but it spins off, again, all this stress that people point to as the problem. But I will tell employees with employers to go in and say, I need these certain things to help me perform better. I haven't necessarily told my employer that I'm ADHD.
Okay.
But now it's a strength-based model. I know what I need, and I know how I work best, and how can we do that together and get there? And so, as I will tell clients, when you go to talk to employers or you talk to your boss, I mean, one of the simplest structures, Pamela, is to have them set up a personal agenda of 5-6 items that they know they're responsible for in their job. And then to do little drive-bys, as I would call it, with their boss, or 5 or 10 minute meetings once or twice a week. Hey, am I on track with this project? Just wanted to be sure I didn't miss a detail. It helps them as what I call as a touchstone of work. And it's just good practice in general for anyone, right, with under today's stress. But for someone with the diagnosis of ADHD, it helps them to be much more effective and much more accountable and responsible. But their boss or other people around them are gonna start to see it as the strength. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It also, I'm wondering if you would recommend that folks, including ADHD, not exclusive to ADHD, take a look at the Americans with Disabilities Act to see what, if any, protections they have.
Yes, I would encourage them to really look at it, because there is a lot of protection that is afforded by the Americans with Disabilities Act. I still think that, unfortunately, as I would call the informal nature of relationships at work and other places many times, leads employees or leads employers at times to make knee-jerk reactions about the diagnoses. And I'm still an advocate of going in and asking for what you need in ways that are reasonable. Yet, if the diagnosis of ADHD is accurate, and it is there, and you need accommodations that you cannot simply get at work by asking for them, then yes, I tell my clients to take it to an HR department. It's a confidential issue, and to manage it that way. And many of my clients have done it successfully, and some have not. Some have felt targeted after they've done that, and so that's a really fine line to balance. And I'm not going to talk about it real honestly, because I think adults with ADHD need to know that's how society is set up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You make the comment that your brain craves stimulus, which we understand, certainly with ADHD. You also
sure.
say that creating a dramatic situation by waiting until the last minute to meet a deadline, while it may be a way to give your brain the stimulation it craves, might not be the smartest way for you to function in your life.
Right. So if you look at this craving stimulus space, as I said earlier, you know, we gravitate toward high stress, conflict, and intensity. Okay, I think some of that is liking the nature of that kind of disruption, so to speak. It's fun, and if you look at like entrepreneurs in the world, and I don't have a reference to the study right offhand, but there was one study that showed up to 50% of entrepreneurs could have ADHD. because they think outside the box. They crave the stimulus, and they really want to jump the gap on a new idea, and they have the energy to do it. So in the craving stimulus space, it's the understanding that I do crave that. How do I make it functional? So how do I go ride a roller coaster that I know I'm going to get on, and it's going to go up and down, versus not paying attention to something, and that I'm, you know, craving a stimulus to do something that is annoying to somebody else or that is disruptive to a party or those kind of things. I just get my clients to really look at the functional way to go after stimulus if that's what they want.
Gotcha. James, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some of the tools. And in particular, you talk about something called the intuition walk, which is really kind of fascinating. So we'll probably pick up with that when we return. Folks, I will continue after this short break with my conversation with James Ochoa, who is the author of Focused Forward, Navigating the Storms of Adult ADHD. Don't go away. You identify several important tools that are useful in navigating what could be a storm. And it was interesting to me that you include among your tools the use of intuition. Talk about that.
I'd be happy to. If we, when we start talking about the tools regarding navigating the storms that come and spin off the adult ADHD diagnoses, or again, ADHD across the life spectrum. One of the hardest things, you know, to begin with, Pamela, was that, you know, and I told me and my clients is the storms are not going to go away. That was it's still a very difficult thing to tell clients that these things are going to be disruptive from times. But when we look at tools on how to manage those storms when you're in them, intuition is a very intriguing one. Intuition being identified, as I talk about in the book, as kind of a sixth sense. It's a knowing without knowing. It's a gut instinct. There's been a lot of research on it in different ways. How I talk about it is if I go back to these personal patterns or strategies or routines again, or rebuilding your internal sense of yourself around the ideas of self-esteem or identity, when you start to do this, your sense of intuition or how you make decisions or what is best for you can really drive a sense of purpose and a sense of connection in your life that you either walked past, never really noticed because you were under so much stress. But as you begin to treat the diagnosis of ADHD, you begin to get this sense that, okay, and, you know, it could be as simple as, Pamela, as, you know, what kind of food do I want to eat tonight? Okay, what kind of ice cream do I like? Well, those preferences and those choices have an intuitive kind of response to them. And I talk about intuition being, it's generally a very quick response. It's not something that you analyze and think about. It's a feeling state of like, oh, that's right for me. This is going to fit. That's exactly what I want to do at this time, like going to a movie or somewhere like that. So, and, you know, we referenced a little bit that we talked about the idea of the intuitive walk, which is an exercise in the book. And that's to give somebody with a diagnosis of ADHD a sense of freedom and a sense that I can know myself and a sense of what does it feel like for me when I go to make my own decisions on an intuitive level. So simply, you know, this intuitive walk is taking some time in a day, 2, 3, 4 hours, and go to a part of a city you'd like to be in, or go to and around your neighborhood, but you just begin walking somewhere, and when you get to a decision point, you know, a corner or a fork in the road, so to speak, you ask yourself, which way do I want to go? And you follow that immediate decision that comes from it in a situation where there is not a high degree of expectation or threat or problems or things I have to accomplish. I'm just learning to feel what it's like for to make decisions on what we would call an intuitive level. We all have a sense of intuition. Some people, it is stronger than others. Maybe that's because they've practiced it. Maybe they were born with it more effectively. Within the diagnosis of ADHD, it gives me an internal bearing. And, you know, in my introduction, I talk about, you know, finding the North Star inside of you, which is always constant. And to me, that's my little voice of intuition that helps me to know what I want to do and when I want to do it. Does that give you some explanation to help a little bit?
It does, but when I hear you saying 2, 3, 4 hours, if this is an adult who has responsibilities, I don't think they're going to be able to take 2, 3, 4 hours a day to do this.
Okay. All right. That is probably a high ideal of mine, which is I've been known to have a few high ideals in my life of, you know, wanting to do things like stretching them a little further than they need to be. But say someone takes 15 minutes, someone takes 30 minutes, okay, or someone takes an evening to themselves, and they say, you know, I'm going to do just what I feel like doing this evening. And so they begin to back that up to a point where it's about staying connected to yourself rather than being driven by the stress or the chaos in your life, which I think you would agree that we could all benefit from. The
Absolutely.
Stress and chaos in our life is just enormous in today's world. You know, and I personally have had to amp up my own self-care around that stress and chaos, oh, I would say 40 or 50% over the last 5 to 10 years because of the stress in the world. We've got to learn to take care of ourselves more effectively.
Well, that is certainly very true. What the first tool that you talk about under important tools is the tool of acceptance, and I think that's kind of what we've been talking about throughout our time today. But just say something a little bit more targeted about accepting the diagnosis.
I'm happy to, because if you look at the idea of acceptance, acceptance means that I'm not going to try to be someone different than I am, first of all. I'm going to acknowledge and get information, in this case, about the diagnosis of ADHD and what it means. I am not going to run away from a storm when it's happening, but I'm going to use my resources many that are in the book, but I'm going to stay in it and say, I can do this. And so acceptance really is saying that, all right, I want to understand the diagnosis. I want to understand its developmental life course for me, how it's going to affect me when I'm 40, 50, 60, 70, and what am I going to do about it? How am I going to take care of it? So to me, acceptance is really acknowledging the challenges that come from it, but it's also beginning to live on what I call as the thriving side of life, really being able to make choices in my life that I'm excited about. Where I really can see things come true that I've wished for forever. And so acceptance is really sitting in that space of, I know what this is, and I know I'm working on managing it, and I will the rest of my life.
Okay. And with that acceptance is a measure of freedom I would offer. What do you think?
Yes, with anything. So when you accept something, you immediately take down the wall of resistance. When we take down the wall of resistance, now we've taken down the resistance that can activate survival or distress or defensiveness in our life. So yes, there's a huge degree of freedom that comes from that sense of acceptance, because there's no longer that wall of resistance of us debating and trying to figure our way or qualify some way around it. It's like, no, this is what it is, and I'm not going to run from it, and I'm going to learn to manage it.
And so, again, at the point of acceptance, you begin to be able to shift all that energy that you put into denial, which is often significant, and actually move the energy to a more useful place within yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And those useful places, after using many of the tools, whether they're intuition or imagination or humor or those kinds of things, you really do begin to rebuild this internal sense of yourself much more effectively. And, you know, I talk about that in the last part of the book about advanced life empowerment skills, which are really things about when I'm going through aspects that spin off of or come as a result of the diagnosis of ADHD, these are the things that I can do to take care of myself. And I'm, you know, really, really excited about a lot of the tools that are in the book. I've seen them work for many clients for many years.
You talk about the tool of strategic therapeutic daydreaming, which sounds strategic and therapeutic, doesn't sound like it belongs with the concept of daydreaming. So help me understand that one.
Yes, I'm so glad we got around to this one. This is the one I've actually been waiting for, to be honest with you, because it's the one that I'm actually have probably the most excitement about. So much of what I discovered, Pamela, in looking at the mental emotional stress of the emotional distress syndrome of ADHD, is that the idea of therapeutic daydreaming is that an adult with a diagnosis of ADHD can begin to build internal worlds in the virtual reality of their own imagination, their mind, and they begin to use those virtual worlds, Pamela, to really calm themselves, to feel confident, to feel creative. In that space of doing it, now they're daydreaming in a very functional way. They have slowed themselves down, and they are visualizing these ideas in their imagination that help them to stay centered. And it's more time, really, than I think we even have on this show today. But I think an example is if you look at, I help people build what we call virtual worlds in our imagination. One of them is an emotional safe space. And it's a space that I can retreat to inside of me that no one else has access to. And the mental and emotional safety that comes from that, Pamela, I cannot tell you how helpful that has been. And I really didn't have the science around the ideas of imagination and how to use what I call therapeutic daydreaming. You know, for 10 years ago, 12 years ago, it was not something I conceptualized, but it really wasn't something I had honed in on. And so to give you a brief example of the ideas in an emotional safe space, which I have created my own virtual worlds that I rely on for strength and courage inside me, to calm the stress of ADHD that comes in ways I could never predict. And, you know, so one, and I have great moments in my imaginary history in the book that people can go and read about the worlds I've created. But in brief, you know, one section I have is I have an entire rainforest in my virtual reality, and I can hear the rain, I can smell the rain, and I've laid a hammock between these trees, and I can lay in the hammock and really calm myself when I've been upset, or I can stay connected to myself when I'm under positive stress, right? And I'm trying to close a $1 million deal, or I want to get someone to fund me, or I have my ideas, I'm trying to put an app together. I can feel calm inside myself and hold that calmness in a greater way if I use my imagination, I use these virtual worlds, And I call it therapeutic daydreaming. It's daydreaming for a very functional reason, and it is the change point on the diagnosis of ADHD, Pamela, that I'm excited to tell people about now, and that it has taken me years to figure out, but it is a sense that really works. So does that help you understand a little bit about what it is?
It really does, and actually it's kind of exciting to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And I could certainly see it as a tool that would be very useful for people other than those with an ADHD diagnosis. You know, I'm thinking
yes.
about anxiety, I'm thinking about
yes.
PTSD, lots of things could be useful.
Yes. So, and I would love to, and I've actually, you know, considered that what I've working on and discovering is that I could take all the ADHD markers out of this book, and it's a very good book about mental and emotional stress and how to handle it. And I believe I've had comments from my copy editor and other folks who don't have ADHD at all, who have said that they forgot it was a book about ADHD in reading some of the concepts, much like, because it helps with anxiety.
Yeah.
It could help with depression. It could help with calming yourself in a nervous situation. Certainly. Yeah, absolutely. It's a big part of that.
Yeah. You've done an excellent job, I would say, in creating the concepts, but certainly delivering the concepts in a way that is very readable and understandable and, quite frankly, doable, which is a good thing.
It is. It is. I wanted to make this a very a pragmatic book, one that you could put into play now. It's something I tell you, I've been on this hunt for decades because I wanted a book about ADHD to go beyond simple strategies or to go beyond the ideas of medication and all these other pieces that are out there already. We've got to get people tools that they can use today in a readable format.
Right.
So one of the things I did as a result of that is I made sure that I did the audio version of the book is also out. And I personally recorded that in the studio here in Austin. Because I wanted it to have that personal resonance. And my youngest son, Jules, who's 20 at college, anyway, he came in, he read the quotes in the book. So it was a great father-son project, and I had a really good time doing it. But the folks with a diagnosis of ADHD, many of us don't read books or don't get around to it, right?
Right.
It's much easier to listen to a book, so the audiobook is also out there, and I knew that was going to be necessary under this diagnostic or under these issues with ADHD that we're talking about.
That is great to hear that option is available. Tell us how folks can learn more about what you're doing as we wind up our time today.
Well, all of my materials and things you can get to are, if you looked up jamesochoa.com, information about the book and information about my website is out there. I also have information on the Life, if you looked up the Life Empowerment Center, you will also see information about my practice. I'm just in the process of finalizing a new website that will all come under jamesochoa.com.
And spell James Ochoa for us.
Yeah, so it's jamesochoa.com.
Okay.
And that's a great place to find information about all the things that I have going forward.
Wonderful. James, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. I think it's been really delightful and really helpful for a lot of folks, so thank you.
Well, I really appreciate all the efforts you've put out in helping the world of mental health. And in particular, this is such a near and dear topic to me, so thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely, my pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. The best way to be in touch is by going to the website, which is myndtalk.org. And remember, folks, always, if it's unacceptable, then that is exactly and precisely what it is. Unacceptable. You take care. Thank you.